20th from noon to 7 and the 21st from noon to 5 in Westside Park. The festival will feature 53 local and regional artists, entertainment on the stage, and activities for the whole family.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. This is the second hour of the program, and in this hour, we'll be talking about the American auto industry. It's certainly the case that American car makers have had a pretty good summer for themselves. They've attracted many buyers by offering consumers the same prices that they charge their own employees. However, a lot of people who follow the industry look at a long-term question. Yes, the automakers have done well by offering what some people would call a gimmick, but there still seem to be some big questions about the long-term future of Detroit. And so we thought we would take up this and perhaps some other questions in this part of the show with a journalist who has been following the auto industry for quite a long time now. Micheline Maynard is her name. She's a reporter on both the auto and airline industries for the New York Times and authored a book that was published a couple of years ago. A book, by the way, that's still available, a book titled The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market, that was first published in the fall of 2003 and is now available in a paperback edition out there in the bookstores. If you want to read the book, you can go and look for it. Also this morning, as we move through the hour, we'll take questions, like always, and we'll be happy to have callers. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. And that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. And that's 800-222-9455. If you're in and around Illinois, Indiana, any place the signal naturally travels, and it would be a long-distance call, use that number. In fact, anybody listening, if you'd be happen to be listening on the Internet, you can also use the toll-free, as long as you're in the United States. So again, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Ms. Maynard, hello.
Hi. Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. And yourself?
Just fine.
Say, thanks very much for talking with us again.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Ever since the last time we talked, I thought we had a good conversation. And from time to time, I'm thinking, you know, we should ask her if she would do a show with us again. And finally, we said, yeah, we should do that and have you on. So I appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Great. I'm happy to do it.
The thing I thought I would talk about, and this has to do more with marketing, I guess, than with the actual product and how it's constructed. But I'm interested in talking a little bit about what's happened this summer with the employee discount offer that first was offered by General Motors. And I think then when Chrysler and Ford saw how well that was doing for GM, they said, well, we should do this too. And in fact, they have sold a lot of cars that way. Whose idea was this? Or was there a specific person who came up with offering this this kind of deal to regular consumers?
Well, what's very interesting about this is if you live in the Detroit area, all year long you're bombarded with ads offering the employee discount, friends and family. I mean, it's been said that each person who works at Ford, for example, gives that discount away to eight other people. And so it's one of the reasons why when you drive around here, you see so many American cars. It was really an idea that just percolated up from the marketing staff at General Motors. And it was one of those things that, you know, let's give this a try and see if it'll matter. Well, the discounts were so significant off of these vehicles that it did matter to people who were planning to buy American and just waiting for the best deal.
So did they end up making money as a result?
Oh, no. I mean, don't think about it as, you know, the joke in the auto industry is we'll make it up on volume. In this case, they were giving away pretty much, you could think of these as double the incentives that they would have given away otherwise. So say if it's a Ford Explorer and there was a $4,000 rebate, you got another $4,000 off the Explorer, which is a terrific deal for anybody buying a vehicle, but it's profit that the or at least revenue that the auto companies are giving away. So I don't expect their third quarter results to be very good, because they sold a lot of vehicles, but they lost money on them.
Well, so then other than moving a lot of inventory, cars that had already been manufactured and were just sitting there, did this do anything for the automakers?
Well, that in itself is pretty important, because what's happened in the last couple of years is that the car companies and the dealers have started the new model year with a lot of the old vehicles left over from the previous year. And what that means is the car companies like to raise the price on the new model year vehicles. But when you have a brand new General Motors something that's a month old from the 2005 model year sitting next to one for the 2006 model year, people can say, why should I pay more for that? So that in itself will help. In other words, they cleared out inventory that would have just been sitting there for months, and it starts the new year off a little bit fresher for the car companies. But what it also did was, you know, it just put product out there. It just means that there are a lot of new vehicles out on the streets, and that's good. I mean, that's a good thing for the Detroit companies, because there are more of their vehicles out there. People can see what they look like, which they, you know, some of them couldn't. The flip side to that, though, is if there are any recalls or any problems with any of these vehicles, now there are more of them out there, and that kind of word of mouth would spread, too.
Yeah. What I think is interesting, I think some people would argue that what this does further, it takes a further step down the road that we've been going down for some time now, and that is you teach consumers that if you wait long enough, someone's going to offer you some kind of good deal, and it'll be better than the deal from last week. And I think that probably happened once people got used to something like 0% financing. That'll be great for a while, but then after a while, people are going to say, okay, now what are you going to do for me today? If you get people used to employee pricing, then that'll maybe going to work for a while, but then perhaps people will say, well, let's wait and see what kind of deal they can do for us now.
Yeah, it does become a vicious circle, and what it does is it's like furniture. You're constantly putting your vehicles on sale, and you're devaluing your brands. And so if there ever comes a time when you want to try to sell something without an incentive on it, it just gets harder and harder. So what's happening in the car business is that the markets are dividing into sort of the quality and the higher-priced vehicles that hold up better, that last longer, that have a better resale value versus the stuff that's sold at a discount. And it just depends on what people prefer. I mean, there are some people that are very loyal to Detroit vehicles, and Detroit vehicles are certainly better than they used to be, and so they're getting amazing bargains. On the other hand, I've had a lot of people call me up and say, you know, I bought this vehicle, I got a $5,000 rebate, and then the month after I bought it, I had to take it in. You know, and it's just been junk ever since I bought it. But I didn't want to spend the extra $5,000 at a Honda cost, you know, for example. I say, well, you know, you get what you pay for. I mean, you get a bargain up front, or you get a bargain or a good value over the life of a vehicle, and you just have to make the decision on what works best for you or for your family.
Yeah. I read an article. This was one that was written by the Washington Post auto guy, Warren Brown.
Warren Brown, sure.
And that I thought was pretty interesting. And the headline on the piece is, "Do Automakers Grasp Why Employee Discounts Worked?" And he makes this argument, you may indeed have read the story, he makes this argument that one of the things that people found appealing was that people, they don't like buying cars. They don't like that little song and dance you have to go through with the salesperson. And there was some appeal to the idea that they didn't have to feel that they had to negotiate. They didn't have to go through all that. That they just walked in, they said, how about this car? The person said, here's the price, and that was that. Either you take it or you don't. And some people, I think, are speculating that one of the results of this program, this employee discount program, is that it's going to change, it may indeed change the way that cars are priced or sold or something like that, that automakers are going to have to do something about the price they're putting on the cars. But maybe all this business of, you know, special sale today and this kind of special discount and that kind of special discount, that people don't like that, and that car retailers are going to move away from doing that kind of stuff.
Well, if you remember back when Saturn was introduced by General Motors in 1990, one of the ideas that they had was sort of this no-haggle pricing,
right,
that they would just set a reasonable price, you would come in and you would pay it. And it worked for a while. And when it stopped working was when sales of Saturn fell off, and Saturn, like everybody else, had to start wheeling and dealing. The auto industry moves in trends, and when everybody gets a deal, everybody's happy. But the minute that the deal goes away, then it becomes so competitive, and everybody doesn't want to feel like an idiot because their neighbor got a better deal than they did. So I think that this is temporary, frankly. I think that there are some things that are really inherent in the car business, and unfortunately, haggling is one of them, and that can only be addressed for a short period of time. And then it's just so deeply baked in that we just aren't ready to move away from that.
Back when, and I believe, at least when I remember reading some of the things that that were in print when you were talking about End of Detroit when the book first came out, it said that you were, one of the things that interested you was back at the point when the first 0% financing plans came out, and that the result was, among other things, was tremendous sales. They set records for sales. But that when the dust settled on that, it turned out that in spite of that, the companies that were selling imports gained market share, and that so it makes me think about that time and also this time and this bigger question of, you know, over time there are ups and downs, and U.S. automakers might find something that they can do to get people jazzed about buying American cars. But overall, there's been this serious problem for them of losing market to foreign producers. Where does that stand now?
Well, what had happened this year before the employee discounts came about was that the foreign car makers were just picking up gobs of market share. The market had, I think I had said in my book that the market would probably divide 50-50 by the year 2010. Hmm. And at points this year, it was dividing 55-45. So we were way ahead of what I predicted on dividing the market between foreign and domestic brands. And I think that with the inventories just swelling of Detroit vehicles, that they felt that it was time for some pretty dramatic action. So what's happened is Detroit's market share has jumped as a result of these employee discount programs. The problem is that's not sustainable, as you said at the beginning of the program. And so right now, yes, Detroit has picked up some market share, but they just can't afford to keep offering the employee discounts. Their costs are not low enough to do that. At some point, those will have to come off, and then that's when we'll go back to this import market share growth. I really don't think Toyota is terribly worried about this at this point in time. I don't think the German automakers and Hyundai are either, because I think they know that this is temporary.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Micheline Maynard. She's a reporter on both the auto and the airline industries for the New York Times and is author of a book, The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. That book was first published in the fall of 2003. It is still available. It's out in a paperback edition if you'd like to read it. Questions are welcome. We got a couple here who are ready to go. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we'll talk with someone in Indiana on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. I've got two questions. I hope they're turned into two questions. It's sort of a conglomerate, and I was hoping you could speak to it or around it. Some time ago, it may have been on David's program, but anyway, somebody mentioned that every time a car rolls off the Detroit line, $1,200 of it goes to pay for insurance for workers. And his position was that, you know, that's already built into the price, and other countries don't have to worry about that because they have, you know, basically a national insurance. And my question sort of deals around that. I was just wondering, if we divide the car up, what percentage or whatever amount goes to pay the workers, you know, actual hourly wages and other things that you could think of. And I was wondering, what is the, you know, when I was coming up as a youngster, my grandfather, who sold Hudson's, in fact, until they went under, and then he became a used car salesman, his rule of thumb was that anything you buy, there's a 1,000 or 100%, however you look at it, markup on stuff. And I was wondering if that's true today or whether or not the profits that Detroit actually get is much slimmer. And I wonder if you could go into the mathematics of that and intertwine it with, you know, the actual cost for the American manufacturers vis-a-vis, you know, the foreign people in their cars, if at all possible. Thanks a lot.
Sure. Well, those are two questions, and let me address each of them separately. First of all, what he's talking about is what the industry calls legacy costs. And this is the cost of health insurance and pensions for the workers, the retired workers, and their families. Now, General Motors over the years has had one of the most generous health care plans in the industry. They have insurance not only for the person that worked for the company, but their spouse, their children, and the insurance continues after they're retired. And then you add in pension costs on top of that. And so together those expenses equal $1,800 a vehicle on some vehicles. The average is about $1,400. So in other words, to make a dime of profit, a car company first has to earn $1,400 on a vehicle. Now, they're not earning anything like that. General Motors actually lost money on its automotive operations during the second quarter. I mean, they're basically earning extremely small profits or losing money on every vehicle that they build. Things were a little bit better at Ford Motor Company, but not much. And now with what's happened during the third quarter, with all of these sales at an unprofitable level, I don't think either one of these companies are going to be making any money on their automotive operations. At the best that GM has done lately was in the fall of 2003, right around the time my book came out. And at that point in time, they were making $50 a car, which actually now looks pretty good compared with the kind of losses that these companies are experiencing.
And I think the caller was also interested in making some comparisons between how much what the big three make on a car and what somebody like, Toyota, Honda, Volkswagen, Mercedes-Benz, an import car. How much do they make on a car?
It's a little bit difficult to quantify that because they don't break down their profits by region. But just to give you an example, Toyota has earned about $10 billion a year worldwide over the last couple of years. Its earnings actually fell a little bit during the past year. One of the reasons is currency. It's the strength of the dollar and some other factors like that. And so the profits that those companies are making are quite impressive. Now, Mercedes-Benz is an example of a company that's not making any money. They are having a very hard time. One of the problems that Mercedes is suffering from is the image that it has some quality problems. And so actually that's one of the reasons why the CEO at Daimler Chrysler is stepping down earlier than expected, because they need to fix the problems at Mercedes-Benz. But if you look at the Japanese as a whole, the Japanese companies have had robust profits for their corporate operations, and I just unfortunately I can't break that down by vehicle.
Okay, another caller here in Belgium near Danville, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. My question deals with another aspect of the automotive industry here. We are essentially just sold cars. We're not really asked that. Do I want to drive a Hummer or do I want to drive an efficient, very price-conscious and very gas miserly type automobile? We're given the advertisement says this is the one you want. You want this great big sucker that's going to take you no place on a gallon of gas. And so General Motors whichever car manufacturer you want to talk about, has lost a ton of money on these things because people are beginning to realize that we've been complaining about gasoline prices for a long time, and now they're just getting worse and worse. Why in the world don't they put a little effort into making a very good car that gets a lot of mileage, and they'd sell them by the tons?
Well, first of all, the sales figures don't really bear that out. And one other thing you have to remember is that the sales figures that you see are sales of new cars. What we also have in this country is a very robust used car market. So there's about 3 used cars sold for every new car. So what's selling in the new car market until recently have been pickup trucks, SUVs, minivans, vehicles, luxury cars, vehicles like that. There are fuel-efficient vehicles available. General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler have not promoted them. They are out there. But they make their money on these big pickup trucks and SUVs. That's where the profit centers are. Now, by contrast, what Toyota and Honda have done over the years, because they have to sell fuel-efficient vehicles. Their market in Japan, when I was living in Japan in the year 2003, people were paying $6 a gallon for gasoline. It's a small country. Their roads are not as wide as our roads. They have terrible traffic problems. They have to come up with a solution to their fuel economy issues. And so back in 1996, Toyota made a commitment that it was going to build what are called hybrid electric vehicles, like the Toyota Prius. Back around that same time, General Motors could have made a similar commitment, and they did come up with an electric vehicle, which was sold in very small numbers in California, but it really didn't put the emphasis on hybrid electric vehicles, because from Detroit you hear that we'll all be driving hydrogen fuel cell vehicles in 20 years. Well, maybe 20 years from now, although I tend to doubt that, but right now we have a fuel crisis, and right now they don't have the numbers of vehicles that people want to own and want to pay money for. They put their money where they thought the profits were.
Well, you just come exactly along with what I say, because they advertise the ones that they think they're going to make the most money on. That's why people buy those, because they see that on television. We're all sheep. We follow what somebody tells us on TV or whatever.
Well, we're not all sheep, simply because Toyota's had tremendous success with the Prius.
I understand.
Far more Priuses than they ever expected that they would sell.
I understand that, and that's because we're becoming more and more conscious of this fuel thing. But why can't they think a little farther ahead? Then they wouldn't have this problem of not having enough money, because, like you said, today you can't buy a Prius unless you want to take delivery in the future.
Well, it is a sense that if you come to the Detroit area and you look around, you would think that Detroit still had 90% of the car market. And that's what they see when they look out the window. It's almost like a mirror, in a sense. And the rest of the country, I mean, you get beyond the Detroit area, you go to Chicago, you go to California, you go down to Alabama and Texas, you see foreign import vehicles all over the place, and yet you don't see them in Detroit. And I think that this whole thing kind of perpetuates itself. There's never been any competition here in the Detroit area, and that's what they see. And I think that that's held them back. I think there's a real lack of understanding of what's happened in the rest of the country. And I do think that there are fuel-efficient vehicles for sale. There just aren't as many being sold by Detroit because, as you said, they don't promote them.
And also you have to get the fuel-efficient vehicles that Detroit is trying to sell us fall far short of fuel efficiency. There's surely much more that can be done to increase the distance we can go on a mile of fuel, whatever the fuel may be. And they just don't want to put the effort into it because they are tied tightly to the particular type of internal combustion engine that they are building.
Well, one of my students when I was teaching at the University of Michigan did a study on what it would take to build more fuel-efficient cars. And this student concluded that with a minimum investment of $2 a vehicle, we could get an improvement in fuel economy. But we're talking about companies that make millions of vehicles a year. So $2 times 8 or 9 million vehicles adds up to a lot of real money. And to these fellows, 50 cents a vehicle is a lot of money. But I think that now, in hindsight, looking back at it, that they missed a shift among American consumers. And I actually chalk it up not just to an interest in fuel efficiency or the environment, but the curiosity factor. I think that the people who get into Priuses, who really enjoy the Prius, are as excited about it as anybody is excited about a Corvette. It's just filling a different need. It's not filling a need for power and speed. It's filling more of an intellectual curiosity on those parts. And I don't think Detroit executives necessarily have picked up on that. I think it's something that's happened to the country while they were thinking we all wanted V8s.
I can't understand when you say that they're not willing to pay $2 more for a higher efficiency. I'd be willing to pay $10 more for the cost of that in the car that I'm going to save $100 down the road.
Right. I don't disagree with you, and I'm sure you're willing to do that, but it's kind of like the airlines. I mean, everyone says, I'd be willing to pay $10 more for a good meal or to get pillows and pretzels back, but then when you go on Travelocity to go buy your ticket, if it's exactly the same time, you're going to buy the ticket that's $10 cheaper. You know, and so there aren't enough people buying Detroit vehicles to convince Detroit that that's what buyers want. They're not able to look at Toyota and say, oh my gosh, people are willing to wait 2 years for a Prius. Maybe they'd be willing to wait 2 years for a General Motors hybrid electric vehicle. But if there was one, GM would now be 5 years behind Toyota in bringing out hybrid electric vehicles, and Toyota's got a real jump on General Motors.
Well, here again, it goes right back to what they want to advertise. If they want to advertise something that's going to be more value to you and say, look, you pay $10 more and it's going to save you $20 in the next year, maybe they could convince other people to go that way, but they don't look at it that way.
Well, it's also a lack of credibility at this point. I mean, I think if General Motors decided we're going to only advertise our fuel-efficient vehicles, there'd be people like you saying, yeah, you could have been doing that for the last 10 years. Why didn't you? You know, so there's a believability factor at play as well.
Yeah, I appreciate the comments of the caller. It also occurs to me, though, that while it is true that there has been tremendous interest in the Prius and demand, and a lot of people lining up, and in fact, people willing to pay a premium, they're willing to pay more than the sticker price in some cases to get the car. Until recently, it seemed that there were a lot of other American drivers who were driving vehicles that were maybe not all that fuel efficient, that were grumbling about the price of gasoline, but they were filling up their tanks anyway. Maybe because they thought that they had to, maybe because they thought it was a temporary spike and things would change. Now, with what's been happening over the last couple of months, the continuing price rises and continuingly people raising this question about, well, what's the world oil supplies look like, and will there be decline in the future? That you would think that would lead towards greater demand for more fuel efficiency. But I wonder, when does the demand truly start to pick up? What is the relationship between people's genuine concern about efficiency and the price? And then eventually, how does that translate it into demand for vehicles? And then finally, when does it get to the point where the industry, you know, it's going to be, when are we finally going to get their attention and they're going to say, well, maybe now, you know, better late than never?
Right. Well, one of the companies that's really moved hard on this is Toyota. And they announced a couple of weeks ago that they're going to introduce 10 hybrid electric vehicles over the next few years. And in my book, in fact, they say that by the year 2010, about 2012, they think they'll be selling 600,000 hybrids a year in the United States. Now, that's leadership. That's not just saying we'll wait until consumers are ready. That's a company saying we think this is the right thing to do. Obviously, we guessed right with the Prius. We're going to expand our offerings. I know that Honda plans to have more hybrid electric vehicles. You know, finally, I think we're hearing Nissan talk about them for the first time. They had kind of resisted this trend. So somebody is showing leadership. It just isn't the Detroit companies. I mean, the Detroit companies, I think, still look at hybrids and think that they're an experiment. And I think that this is a mistake. I think, especially as gas prices go up, that people are very interested in hybrids. People ask me about them all the time. And my nephews, who are age 10 and 14, it's very likely that at some point soon, they'll be buying hybrids. And I really do think there's much more interest on the part of Americans than the Detroit companies have sensed.
One more quick question, and I promise I have some people who are hanging on. They want to get into the conversation. Just on this issue of this question of automotive technology and what kind of car we're going to be driving 5 years from now or 10 years from now or more. The experiments with the all-electric cars just seem to be really problematic because of limits in battery technology. There's been a lot of interest, some people would say hype, in the hydrogen fuel cell. That seems to be a long way away, if ever. If you ask this question, well, what really is new, where's the cutting edge, and what kind of cars will we be driving 5 and 10 years from now? Does it seem that the answer is the hybrid? Is that where we're going to go next?
I think that's the immediate answer. I also think that the auto companies will be doing a lot to improve the fuel efficiency of their conventional internal combustion engines. What I find very interesting is that there have been some studies of hybrids, and some of the studies have found that the fuel economy on them isn't quite what people were expecting. I mean, I think they were expecting to go 100 miles to a gallon. It's not going to be quite that good, and a lot of it depends on the way you drive. And this is a way that you can save money even if you have a regular car, because Americans tend to drive long distances at high speeds. hybrids are best in city driving. They actually get better fuel economy in stop-and-go driving because that's when the battery kicks in. If you're driving at long speeds or long distances and high speeds, even in a hybrid, you will get less fuel economy than you expect because that's when you're burning gasoline. So one of the things that will probably have to happen is we'll have to have some education of drivers about hybrids and what you can get from them. And I think people are going to find out that they can improve their fuel economy just by driving a little bit more conservatively.
Well, we have some other calls to talk with. Let me again very quickly introduce the guest, Micheline Maynard. She's a reporter on both the automobile and the airline industries for the New York Times. In fact, a lot of her recent stories for the Times have been on the airline industry. When I took a look at what you've been writing recently, I started thinking, gosh, maybe we should have been talking about the airlines. But in any case, we're talking about the auto industry and what's been going on recently with American car makers. She's the author of a book that was first published in the fall of 2003 and is still available now out in paperback. Her book is titled The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. We have several callers. We'll go next to talk with somebody in Champaign, line two, right here. Hello.
Hi, yes. You talk about the legacy costs for the unions. You need to consider the CEO pays while you're talking about these things. I just looked up some statistics. Ford CEO has made $53 million over the last 3 years. GM's...
Well, Ford CEO doesn't get a salary. He's basically an owner of the company. His
But there's stock options and grants.
Right. Well, I get stock options, and right now I'm underwater from the New York Times. So you could get stock options, but they have to be worth something.
Okay.
So, but keep going.
GM CEO made $40.7 million over the last 3 years, and Ford's top five executives made $105.5 million over the last 3 years. GM's $104 million. So, I mean, you need to talk about more things other than just the union pensions and health care and such. And you just mentioned the airlines. United Airlines, their CEO made $13.1 million in the 2 years going up into its 2002 bankruptcy.
Right. Well, that's true. I mean, I'm not defending their salaries at all. But just to make a lot of that does come in special compensation that's basically worthless if their stock doesn't hit a particular value.
But
and I'm not saying that it's the workers' fault. I'm a union member. My mom was a member of the UAW. I'm very proud of my union leaders for negotiating the kind of benefits that they've gotten. I'm just stating a fact that at the big three, legacy costs are $1,400 a vehicle. That means that they have to cut costs or be more efficient in their developing in order to afford the benefits that they promised to their workers. I'm not saying workers have to take pay cuts or eliminate their benefits.
Right.
But there's a responsibility for management when you have something like that as a cost, that you have to find a way to run your company around it. And the way that they've chosen to run their companies is by putting everything on sale. When they put everything on sale, they're not going to make the profits that they need to cover their legacy costs. So at some point, you know, push has to come to shove here.
Certainly, I agree. I just wanted to point out that, I mean, the CEOs are doing pretty well while the pensions are actually being underfunded at this point in time for the union workers. And I agree with you. I'm not trying to, push your point on either the union's fault or the CEO's fault.
Right.
And,
no, it's a good point to make, but very interestingly, even though the CEO compensation in the automobile industry looks like it's out of whack with what hourly workers make, it's actually not that bad when you compare it with the entertainment industry, when you look at banking, when you look at other industries where CEOs earn much bigger salaries and get much greater compensation. That said, it is out of balance.
Right. I mean, those other industries are not having to always put their products on sale to make a move off of the lot.
Right. I think one of the key issues here is it really does come down to the vehicle, and it comes down to what people think of it and what they're willing to pay for it. And what consumers are showing Detroit is that they'll buy their vehicles when they're marked down. They're not going to buy them for the prices that Detroit wants to charge for them. But the prices that Detroit wants to charge for them are what will cover its costs. So, you know, there's a disconnect here.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Very good. Okay.
All
thank
right.
you very
well,
much.
Thanks
thank
for
you
the
for
call.
Calling.
Let's go to line three. This is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to know if you could touch on the E85 product coming out for the newer cars, because there's a lot of older cars out there, and those people are going to hold on to those cars because they can't afford to buy one. And what's GM's thinking since that product's coming online?
Well, I think that's a very important issue, and I think one of the things that's happened with all of these employee discounts is that they've really flooded the market now with new vehicles. And, you know, what I'm a little bit concerned about for them is that it's sucked up any demand that there might be in the next few years for these new vehicles that would be more fuel efficient, better developed, better looking vehicles. So, you know, to solve it's that sort of short term thinking again. To solve an immediate problem, they may have hurt their future yet again.
Thanks for your time.
All right, and we'll go to Champaign County line number one for another call. Hello.
Hi. There's something about calling those legacy costs that's kind of disturbing to me. It seems to imply that they don't plan on doing that again, that they don't plan on having a fair job with compensation, health care, and all that. So that's just that's probably people will say that's inevitable because of globalization, which ties into my first question, which I prompted me to call, which was when we talk about a U.S.-built car, you know, or a U.S. car company, and, you know, there's a lot of overlapping circles there. I remember seeing a diagram of a Buick, which was allowed to be labeled as American-made, and they had outsourced so much of the components that, you know, it's like 60% was built in Mexico, Philippines, other places, you know. So then you have the other side of the coin, which is that, you know, there is a BMW plant in South Carolina. I understand their values of resale don't go as high as something near that's built near, Baden-Württemberg or something. But it would almost take a good spreadsheet to really line this out. But what are we talking about? How much is made in the U.S. in a U.S. car, and how much is a so-called U.S. car? And if you could sort that out a little bit.
Well, I actually did a piece on that for the Times a couple of months ago that ran on the front page, and we looked at the new plants that have been built in the United States by the foreign automakers. Foreign automakers, you know, non-Detroit companies, I'm not including Chrysler in that group, now build one-third of the vehicles that are produced in the United States. 10 years ago, they built about 15%. So their production has basically doubled in this country over the last 10 years or so. Detroit companies are all building vehicles elsewhere besides the United States. There's a lot of production that's done in Canada. There's quite a bit of production done in Mexico now. In fact, the Hemi engines that Chrysler is advertising in their big pickup trucks, those are built at a plant in Mexico. Next year, we're going to see the first cars built in China that will come to the United States. And I fully expect that one of the big three eventually will be importing cars built in China. At the same time, I haven't really seen any difference in resale value between German vehicles built in Germany and German vehicles built in the United States. In fact, the U.S. is the only place that Mercedes builds the M-Class sport utility vehicle, and they're also about to come out with a new vehicle called the R-Class, which is sort of their version of the Lexus RX 330. So they're only built here, and in fact, the 3 Series vehicles that BMW sells here are built in South Africa. So it's all kind of a big kaleidoscope. And so what we're talking about now when you say U.S. versus import vehicle is really where the brand is based, where the company is based. And I guess in the case of Daimler Chrysler, they're based in Stuttgart. So really, we really only have 2 real American companies left.
But again, the point I was making is that even GM gets a lot of its parts. And I'm wondering if the foreign-based or the foreign-owned U.S.-based factories have an inclination to have more of their own parts and ship them here and just assemble them here, and that kind of thing. But you can go to some of the websites for the used cars, and they do have a button to click for a Jetta.
Right, there's a sticker on the vehicles that states the amount of U.S. content on the vehicles. And for example, these aren't screwdriver plants. Toyota, Honda, Nissan all have American-based suppliers. Now, in some cases, they're American branches of the suppliers that they use overseas in Japan. But in the case of the Honda Accord, I think Honda would say it's about 75% U.S. content. The Toyotas average 60 to 70%. I believe that Mercedes, it's a little higher German content because the engines aren't built in America. They're built in Germany and shipped over here. So it's all, you know, all kind of comes out in the wash in a sense because Delphi, the big parts maker that builds parts for General Motors, they've moved a lot of their production to Mexico and to China as well.
Yeah, I wonder how much union content would then, whether they don't have to put that on their sticker, I trust.
Delphi told me a couple of years ago that they were down to 25% UAW workers building Delphi parts. To just look at a couple of numbers, there were about a million auto workers who were members of the UAW in 1978. That number is now down under about 400,000. And General Motors, you know, once had, I think it was close to 600,000 UAW members. Their number is now under 200,000. And conversely, the new American factories employ close to 80,000 workers who are not UAW members, and that number is going to grow because they're opening new factories.
Okay, well, thanks. But one other thing about the Prius and the hybrids is that the other way they gain in city driving, and I guess it would be true for hilly driving too, is they recoup from the braking. Maybe GM needs that hybrid Hummer whether that's apocryphal or not, a big buy from the Defense Department. There's some military Keynesianism here.
Well, there
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we really won't see the impact of hybrids until there are more hybrids among sport utilities and pickups, and Toyota already has a hybrid Highlander and hybrid version of the RX 330, and that's where they're headed for more of those. So that'll be where the biggest gains are potentially could be.
So what is today the largest car company in the world?
The largest car company in the world is still General Motors.
Mm-hmm.
But Toyota is on a drive to have 15% of the global car market, which would make it bigger than General Motors. They won't say that their goal is to exceed General Motors, but I predict that by the end of this decade, it'll be Toyota.
Yeah, I think that I'm
thinking
about
the richest company.
To what we talked about before, that we would get to this point, and it wouldn't be that far in the future where the company that was the world's biggest car company would no longer be an American.
No, I think that's coming.
You also made the argument that there would be dramatic change for the big three, and that in fact, you think in this book you predicted that at least one of the big three, sometime in the near future, looking in the near future, would not survive in its present form.
Right.
Now I don't know if Daimler Chrysler now qualifies for having already made that prediction come true.
Well, I think what I meant by that was a couple of different scenarios. I think one scenario, which is the most likely, is that they're going to shrink significantly. And we're already seeing that with Ford Motor Company. Ford Motor Company had almost 25% of the American market in the late 1990s, and they're down in the high teens at this point. They've shrunk. General Motors, until it started selling everything at these deep discounts, their market share was deteriorating. Now, Chrysler's a little bit of a different story, and because they're smaller, they may actually have better luck than the other members of the big three. All they have to do to really be successful is have about 15% of the market. That, of course, they have Toyota breathing down their neck, and I think very soon Toyota will be bigger than Chrysler in the United States, and that would displace them as one of the big three.
Hmm. Savoy is next caller here, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I was listening to these engine efficiency comments and everything like that. You know, back in 1962 or 63, Chrysler came out with a gas turbine engine.
That's right, they did.
And Parnelli Jones nearly won the Indianapolis 500 with a turbine over at Indianapolis. You know, it came within a few laps of doing it when the transmission failed. Now, theoretically speaking, and as a practical matter, turbines, a regenerative turbine engine, is the most efficient transportation engine for two reasons. One is it's very efficient fuel-wise. The other thing is it's very lightweight. And you can't hold a candle to a turbine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, why aren't people looking at turbines?
Well, I think one of the biggest problems, I remember reading about this a few months ago, was quality when Chrysler introduced the turbine. First of all, it was just too experimental for the country at the time that it was introduced.
Well, yeah. It
was expensive to build. I mean, turbine engines are what are on airplanes.
Right.
The airplane engines are very expensive to fix. They're also built to be extremely reliable, but you still have accidents where birds get sucked into them. I mean, there are still factors that you can't control with turbine engines. At this point in time, one of the biggest problems is investment money, research and development money. I think if the sky was the limit, the auto companies would be but they've had a really hard time the last 10 years.
Well, you know, you can buy on the open market now, you can buy turbine or jet engines for model airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also you can buy turbine generator sets.
Right.
And, you know, like, you know, it's been 50 years since the 60s, and there's a
40.
Yeah, 40,
Don't rush it.
Yeah. And it's, you know, turbine engines are the weapon of choice. And, you know, if you can buy one for a model airplane,
mm-hmm.
you can certainly build one for a car.
Right, but you have to remember they have to do it times a couple of 100,000, and they have to ensure quality over 5-10 years of time, and they have to they have to have dealers who can fix them.
Well, yeah, and turbines are simple. If you go and you look at one, it's, you know, you've got the compressor on one end of the shaft and the expander on the other and the burner cans in between. That's the reason they use them in aircraft. They're so simple, they're reliable, and they're not that expensive to build. Whenever you build 10 million of them,
right?
You know, right.
Well, it will take somebody to go first. That's the problem, yeah. And Chrysler found out 40 years ago that, you know, people weren't ready. This is just like diesel engines, too. Diesel power can be very efficient power. There are new diesel catalysts in Europe that are much cleaner than diesel engines used to be in the United States. But the image of diesel engines in this country is just so poor that the car companies won't touch diesels. There's only a few heavy trucks and then Volkswagen who sell diesel engines at all. And I think even more than turbine engines, that's a much more accessible technology, but they don't want to touch that either.
We're getting to the point here where we just have a couple of minutes left. I want to get just for a second to get back to the hydrogen fuel cell. The automakers are doing research in that area. And
right.
As I said, some people are jazzed about it and other people say it's hype. Are the American car makers, in fact, any car makers, really serious about, do they really think that there's potential anytime, you know, within the next two decades for a practical, affordable hydrogen fuel cell car? And then the whole issue of the fuel infrastructure, that's yet another issue.
Well, and I think that's the point. I mean, there are hydrogen fuel cell vehicles out there. I've actually driven one. They are available for fleets only because right now this is an experiment. In fact, there are some in use in California. There are some in use in other places. And they have to be run under pretty much controlled situations. There has to be a lot of maintenance and study done of these vehicles. And then you hit on the whole issue of delivery of fuel. The way it would have to be done is you would have to have hydrogen fuel available in this country in some fashion, either at filling stations, at utility companies. There's a method that Honda's looked at where you would siphon off natural gas from your house. It's very technical, and it's a little bit over my head to try to explain on the radio, but there are ways to do it. Unfortunately, the infrastructure investments are massive. And it's also an education process. I think you say hydrogen to an American and they think of the H-bomb. You know, I think they'd be worried that something would be exploding in their backyard. I realize that that's not what's going to happen. But if you think hybrid electric engines take education, wait till we get to hydrogen fuel cells. I really don't think it's going to happen. I really think that the hybrids are the way to go. If you're talking about something that's familiar to an American that they will be willing to get their arms around, and I think hydrogen fuel cells will be in use by bus companies, taxi companies, something like that.
Yeah. So, well, we're just about at the point here. We have to stop. Everybody wants me to ask you what kind of car you drive.
I have a Lexus RX 330 SUV. They call it the ladies SUV. I have gotten, interestingly enough, I've gotten up to 28 miles to the gallon, and it uses regular. I had a Volkswagen Beetle before this, and it got about 18 miles per gallon on premium. Mm-hmm. I'm very happy that I've traded my Beetle in for the Lexus. And, of course, hardly anything ever goes wrong with it. There's a reason why it lands on the top of those quality surveys all the time.
Well, we're going to have to stop. I want, again, to mention, if you're interested in reading a book that looks at what's happened with Detroit in recent years, the book to look at is The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. Came out first in fall of 2003, is now available in a paperback edition by our guest, Micheline Maynard. She's a reporter on the auto and airline industries for The New York Times. Ms. Maynard, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Focus 580, this show is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Programming here on WILL also made possible by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. That is it on Focus 580, but we want you to stay tuned because there will be more news, features, other things, another interview coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine, and the host for that show is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with Matthew Simmons. He heads an investment bank that specializes in the energy industry, and he is the author of Twilight in the Desert, The Coming Saudi Oil Shock, and the World Economy. We'll talk with him this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at prices on the Board of Trade and on the Merck. September wheat, 312 and three quarters, up 2.5. December, 327 and three quarters, up 2.75. September corn, 212, up 2.5. December, 225.5, up 3.25. March, 235, up 3. May, 241, up 2.75. September beans, 619, that up 2.25. November, 627.5, up 2.5. November, 627.5, up 2.5. September soybean meal, 193.60, up 90. September oil, 22.60, up 31. August feeder cattle, 110.20, up 27.5. August live cattle, 79.20, up 42.5. October lean